This is NABA Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting. My name is Cecilia and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
It's good to be here. This meeting is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Our speaker tonight is a gentleman I really don't know that well, but I've seen him in a few meetings. I heard him give a short version of his story at a Saturday morning meeting I went to, and then saw him a couple of times. And we struck up a conversation. He's native Atlantan, and we started talking about some of the places we hung around when we were younger. And I said, I'm sure, I told him before the meeting, I said, I'm sure we crossed paths somewhere back there, that I could have crossed paths with Superman and not remember it now. But I really appreciate him coming and some of his friends from his clubhouse, so please welcome Buster.
Hey guys, I'm Buster Carter. I'm drug addict, alcoholic.
Hello, Buster.
Thank y'all for inviting me here to tell my story tonight. I got to start off by telling you that my wife's in the audience and she has heard my story several times, and she always wants to know which story am I going to tell. And I have to be honest and say I never know. I don't remember much what I say when I tell my stories. I have a great ability to forget things that I don't really want to remember. But like Tim was saying, I'm born and raised here. I was born at St. Joe's Hospital when they used to deliver babies downtown, and grew up in Buckhead. Had two great parents who lived long lives and tried real hard to show me what life was like. I was probably a pretty typical ungrateful child and rebelled against anything they wanted me to do. I grew up on a great street. It was a dead-end street, wasn't very big. Almost all the dads on that street were World War II veterans, and there wasn't much that a thundering herd of kids could do to rattle them, and they gave us a lot of latitude to do a lot of things, and that was great for me. Atlanta was a different town when I grew up. You could go anywhere or do anything and not worry about it. These days I've got six grandkids, and it just scares me to death them going from their house to the pool. I am the oldest of four kids. I have a brother and a sister that are absolutely brilliant, and I have dyslexia, and I went to a Catholic school in Buckhead, Christ the King, and the poor gray nuns there didn't know what to do with me. I had a tremendous spoken vocabulary and couldn't read a thing, and they thought I was lazy and stupid. And I had a brother and a sister that could do anything academically. And that started me off at an early age, not feeling a part of much of anything. I didn't want to be in groups, didn't want to do anything with anybody else in school, because I just couldn't measure up to anyone or anything that was going on. It just made no sense to me. But given the time and the determination of my mother, they kept advancing me in grades. It wasn't until seventh grade that I learned how to read. And I came from a reading family, and reading really became important to me because it was the first place that I found that I could really escape. I could get into a book and just leave everything else behind. We were the kind of kids that you wake up in the morning and mom would kick you out the house and didn't want to see you again till dinner. So we were always doing things, riding bikes, being athletic. And when I was 16, my mother got me some tennis lessons. And it was my first great obsession. Started playing tennis 3 and 4 hours a day every day. And God help my poor family if it rained. That was all I did and all I thought of. And I didn't know what an obsession was. But it consumed me. You could drink legal in Atlanta when I was coming up at 18. We all drank before that. I didn't really like drinking. Hated the taste. My father was a bourbon drinker. Some of my earliest memories are smelling the oranges, the cherries, and the bitters when he mixed an old-fashioned. I'm saying that, and I can remember that smell so well. Why is it that I can remember that smell so well? Hated beer, but that never stopped me from drinking it. First time I got drunk was 15. We were in Augusta at a wedding of a cousin, and my parents really enjoyed the wedding and really had too much to drink and asked me to drive. And unfortunately for them, I had been drinking, but they were far enough gone they really didn't notice that I was driving about 5 miles an hour from the reception back to our hotel because I couldn't drive. Drinking never stopped me from driving. I was bad to drink and drive. As I got close to getting out of high school, I found other drugs, and they were very popular then. And I found that they mixed very well with alcohol. I loved not feeling insecure. I loved feeling a part of when I got high or when I drank. And that carried me through for a long time. I had a good 20-year run of drinking and drugs. It is tough, though. I ended up teaching and playing tennis for a living for a long time, and it's tough to be a professional athlete and drink and do drugs, but that still didn't stop me. I laugh today thinking how old I am. I just turned 63. I can't believe that I am not only this old but still alive. I did everything I could for 20 years to make sure that I wasn't going to live this long. Got married at 21 to someone I had carpooled with since I was 5 years old. I'm not much one for doing things that require me to go outside of a comfort zone. And we were married for 31 years. I drank through a good part of that, and I drugged hard through a good part of that. I did more in the last 18 months drugging than I would have done in the last 20 years drinking. And for that, I'm very grateful for what it did to me. It totally brought me to my knees. Always wanted a family, have a wonderful daughter and a wonderful son. And they were pretty young when I got sober. They were 5 and 8. I did not act, though, like I really cared about them for those first few years because I was the guy that would put them in the car, take them to the 7-Eleven, get them ice cream, candy, Cokes, and then go out and do what I was going to do because no policeman was going to stop me with 2 kids in the car. and incredibly that worked. I never got a DUI. That doesn't mean that I don't have four felonies, though. I got popped doing other things. But, you know, that is such a small part of my life and my story these days. I had really been driven here by consequences. I had tremendous financial problems, incredible legal problems, problems at home. And when I was 34, something happened to where I could just stop for a minute and see what was going on. And I knew I was totally a prisoner of drugs and alcohol. I knew that they totally ruled my life. But I was under the impression that I was still managing my life. I was under the impression that I was still getting by, and in some sense I considered myself the Teflon man. You know, nothing was going to stick. Nobody was going to catch me. I had a real junkie's trust. I trusted that you know, the man was going to answer the phone and he was going to be holding. I trusted that I could get in the truck just as messed up as I was, and I would get home and not kill anybody. I trusted that those people that loved me were still going to be there the next day. That is not the trust I have today. That is not what I believe today. I had been going. I knew that I had to have help, and there was a little treatment center in Smyrna that was famous for its psychiatric care, and I was doing what they called at the time an intensive evening program, which was an hour and a half, two nights a week. And I had done that for 30 days and had not picked up a white chip yet. I still had my truck. I was still married. I wasn't like these people. There was people in my group that had 7 and 8 DUIs that had been in prison. All I'd been in was jail. So I'm comparing myself to them and thinking about how much better I am than they are. And after about 30 days, I had some buddies of mine that happened to own a liquor store in Woodstock call me up. They hadn't been able to get a hold of me. They owed me some money. And it was a friendly debt, and I went up there to collect it. And guys, they had just come out with Jack Daniels premixed in a can with Coke. And it was the greatest thing I'd ever heard of, because my drink was Jack and Coke. So I had a couple talking with the guys up there, and they sent me home with the rest of the six-pack. And it was about a 40-minute drive back, and of course the six-pack was gone before I got home. But for the first time, nothing happened to me. Didn't get high. No buzz. Didn't feel queasy. What was that? You know, the last thing, my last friend, the last thing I could totally count on didn't work. And it scared me to death. That was a Friday night. That Monday, I told our little counselor about it. And she said she didn't know me, but she knew my disease. And I had to go. So this lady leading this group of people that I had looked down on for 4 weeks were giving me the boot. And that was really the first time that I paid attention, that I heard somebody say something to me that I couldn't do. Desperately searched around to find a meeting that night, because what was I going to tell my wife at the time, them sending me home? And Ridgeview was right around the corner, and it was a Monday night. It was a CA meeting. And that was December 2nd, 1988. And I have been a part of that meeting since. I don't miss it much, and I'm missing it tonight. That was the first place I went to where I could relate to what someone told me about my disease. I had no understanding of what the disease of alcoholism and addiction were. Today, I have an absolute understanding of what that disease is to me. There are so many things that being a part of this fellowship that is, has given me. And there's so many things that I never would have had because of what y'all do at meetings in sponsorship for me. And so much of my program is still selfish because of what it does for me. But so much also is what I can do now for other people. When I was out drinking and using, I was worthless to anybody else. I was leaving my kids at soccer practice. My daughter would be after school when I was supposed to pick her up. We'd miss doctor's appointments. You know, it just didn't matter. I'd make an excuse. I'd make a promise I wasn't about to keep again. I was just a sorry person. And I didn't want to be. That was the tough part for me. I was great in intentions. I had great intentions. But my disease helped me not follow through. My disease helped stop me from doing what I needed to do. My mother was a devout Catholic, and I had 12 years of Catholic education here in Atlanta. When I grew up, they were unafraid to teach you anything about any religion around. And I'm very grateful for that. It gave me a great overview. But what it also did was totally turned me against religions. I always confused what spirituality is, it is talked about in AA, is with religion when I first came in. I had a tough first 18 months coming in. Went to a bunch of meetings up at 8111. I lived in Cobb County at the time and in several churches around there. I'd come in 2 minutes before the meeting. I'd leave right after the meeting. I had such a low opinion of myself that you, of course, were going to have the same opinion. You didn't want to meet me. God knows I was scared to death to meet you. Didn't know how to meet anybody sober. Didn't know how to carry on a conversation. I did go to enough meetings, though, to where people started to recognize me, and people would come up and say something to me. I did not get a sponsor those first 18 months. I don't recommend that to anybody. I'm hard-headed, and I'm going to do things my way. And if y'all don't believe me, just ask my wife right over there. She'll tell you. But when I got a sponsor, they asked me to start working the steps with them. And I looked over at those steps, and as I did at every meeting, and there's God, and there's God, and there's this and that. And it set off a prejudice that's talked about in the Big Book. I had an educated prejudice against any religion which I associated with any God. And he was great because he just told me good, orderly direction. That was all I needed, was good, orderly direction. And we worked the steps. Not quick and not easy. But we did. And I hear the term used, gentle discipline, in the program. And that's what it was for me. I learned to come to the meeting 20 minutes early. I learned to stay at least 20 minutes after. I learned to listen when I want to sit and fidget. I learned that it's the message that I need to hear. I don't need to be thinking about the messenger and how it's said. Those things were so important to me when I was first starting out. Was so confused. I had, a few months before I quit, I had pretty much pushed away my family. They were pretty much leaving me alone all the time. I had a ton of money. I had a ton of time to do anything I wanted. And I thought I should be happy. I thought I would be happy. And I was confused because I was utterly miserable. In the first 18 months of sobriety, I was fairly miserable. And that's because, you know, I wouldn't put my hand out and ask for help. That's such an important thing now to me. Somebody I don't recognize in the meetings that we go to, I'm always going up to them and just saying hello. Just telling them who I am, just asking them how their day is. I have met some remarkable people that way. Some people that have just moved to Atlanta, people that are just out of halfway house. I did not sponsor anyone the first probably 10 years of my sobriety. It took me a long time to have enough faith in myself to not think that I would harm someone else's sobriety. But once I started sponsoring people, I found that that is truly for me the road to lasting sobriety. God, right now, I've got some great people I'm working with. Have a doctor that has been driving an Uber for the last 18 months because he's been in timeout with the state medical board, and he's just gotten his license back, and he's going back to work one day a week. I've got a lawyer that for 20 years has struggled being sober, and is a truly religious man who couldn't take his religion from his head to his heart. In the last 18 months, he's been sober. And we talk at least once a week about God and what spirituality is to him. And he called me up two nights ago, really upset that his wife had cried herself to sleep the last three nights because two friends of hers, who've been to rehab a half a dozen times, just can't get it. And we both know that people are going to either get it or not on God's schedule, not ours. And I can talk about that with him. And I can share what I've learned about that because I have a son that for 10 years put us through the ringer. He put me to shame when it comes to drinking and drugging. I thought I was good, but he was so much better. And the first time we pulled him out of an emergency room, it wasn't a real bad overdose. It was enough to scare him. Before that, I'd tried for 9 years, taking him to meetings, putting him a couple rehabs, and nothing worked for getting him sober. And that was the most humbling experience of my life. There was nothing more that I wanted in the world but to have my son get the gift of sobriety. And I couldn't give it to him. And whenever I think I'm all that, whenever I think I've got the world by the tail, I remember that, you know, only God does this for me. Only God does this for somebody else. And if I finally quit doing things for him. And about a year later, the second time, he overdosed. The doctor told me they didn't think they were going to be able to bring him back, but they did. And earlier this month, he picked up a 9-year chip. He's got 4 kids, which I can't believe, but you know, he's married. He is a hard working regular guy. What a You know, I'm just so grateful that I get the opportunity to see this. I mentioned earlier I was married for a long time. Got divorced 10 or 11 years ago. It was very ugly. Some hurts just don't seem to be able to be healed. And was single for a few years and met a wonderful person who had a similar background to me, but who was born and raised in the North. And I didn't know if I could get past that. And an example of how manipulation works and how to get somebody when they're down. I ran into her one night, and her best friend had just died. She was just going in for her second biopsy for breast cancer. And I asked her how she was doing, and she couldn't get the words out. "I'm fine." She started to cry a little bit. And I said, "Oh, here, let me take you to dinner." And what a great thing to have the chance to learn how to be an adult with another adult. I don't know what it's like in general to form and hold and to be consistent with a relationship with another adult without a lot of help. I'm not much on self-reflection. I don't like it a bit. But it's something I have to do all the time. And to be able to go through my life with another person who is such a friend and who means so much to me is just such a great thing. I don't know if it's for everybody, but I know that I couldn't be where I am today without it. I have been involved in service work, I guess, since I started getting sober. It was the only way that I could feel close to anything. Back in the late 80s, you could still smoke at all the clubhouses. And I don't know if y'all been to 8111 or not, but you'd come in that back door and it would be a blue cloud. You couldn't see who was speaking in the front. It was so thick. And I never smoked cigarettes. But I decided that if I was going to do something, I'd start emptying ashtrays. And I did that. They asked me to fix coffee once. I don't drink coffee, and I don't make good coffee. But I was able to feel a little bit a part of something doing that. And, you know, it was the combination of the utter desperation I felt, not wanting to be the person I was, and the need to be a part of something else that kept me in early. And anybody that is struggling with feeling a part of, you know, I just encourage, get with someone. There are a lot of great people in this room that know what it's like to not feel a part of and can help with that. I mentioned I had a couple of great parents. They were actually a much better couple than they were parents. My brothers and sister and I laugh at times that they had kids because everybody had kids. We weren't really sure often that they wanted us. They were great at giving us our independence. But one of the greatest signs, I guess, my mother was not a demonstrative person. She wasn't one to tell you she loved you. But I had just been indicted for something, and was written up in the paper in 86 or 87. And one of my mother's good friends took that article, cut it out, put it in an envelope, and mailed it to her. No note. She did have her name and address embossed on the back of the envelope, so my mother would know who it was. And Mom called me up, had me come over, and showed me that. Can't imagine what it was like for her, but she said she was she still had faith in me. I certainly had none in myself, but she still had faith in me. She still believed in me. My parents were incredibly social people. I grew up around cocktail parties. They loved to entertain. They loved to be entertained. That's what I grew up thinking life was. You know, just a friendly cocktail party, then go home. But that's not what I was. And that's, if I were to start drinking again, that wouldn't be what I am. I'm an alcoholic with an alcoholic mind. I'm never happy with what I have. I always want something more. I always could have done better than what I did in the past. And I know I'm not going to be good enough in the future. And to this day, that is what I fight more than anything else. At times, I also fight the arrogance of time. I've been sober a long time, so I shouldn't feel this, or I shouldn't feel that, or I should have this and not have that. But that isn't what life gives me. Life gives me problems every single day. And life gives me a chance to work on those problems like an adult, which I just don't want to. Like I said, I've had problems with the law in the past, and that has dictated what I did for a living. I couldn't work for anybody because anytime they do a background check, they go, "Oh, no, thank you." Last 2 years, though, I've really thought that it would be great to go to work for somebody else. My knees aren't what they used to be. My temperament sure isn't what it needs to be all the time to have employees who come in half-loaded and always late. So I've worked hard looking for something to do, someone to employ me. And after 30 years, I got a couple of job offers, and one that I'm going to take shortly. And what a remarkable thing for a past convict like me to be able to do. I chose to tell the guy that I'm going to work for about a good deal of my past. Wow, that was uncomfortable. Nobody that's not an alcoholic or drug addict knows much about my story at all. I don't share the details with people. Occasionally, with a customer, I'll mention that I don't drink. I won't mention why. But I didn't want him running the background check and everything turn up and him not already knowing about it. And it turns out it didn't matter that he wanted me because of my skills and my temperament and what I could bring to the company. Had to take a drug test. This was a different thing, not being required to take one, but voluntarily taking one. And I took it at a place out off of East Ponce, and there must have been 70 people in that room taking drug tests, and about half of them were real unhappy about having to do it, and they were negotiating with the people that were happy to do it to see if they could get a little help on those drug tests. You know, things I just don't worry about anymore. It was good to go in there, and even though it was a 2.5-hour wait, get it done and go on. These days I can do that. I don't worry about the policeman pulling up behind me anymore, unless I'm speeding. Even when I'm speeding, all that happens is you get a ticket. Well, that isn't always what happens. 5 years ago, I got a ticket for no seatbelt. I'm learning how to use computers. I think I've got this down, right? I pay the ticket online, $15 ticket. Don't think about it again. A year and a half later, I bought a new truck, came from out of state, had an out of state tag on it, and Cobb County pulled me over. And, you know, they wanted to see the paperwork. I showed them the paperwork, no big deal. But it was taking forever. And all of a sudden, another cop car pulls up. And what's going to happen when another cop car pulls up? I'm going to jail. Why am I going to jail? Turns out I didn't finish the transaction on these $15 seatbelt violation. That seatbelt violation cost me $1,750 because I got a non-appearance. You know, I had to reinstate my license. So I go from being a common criminal, getting away with everything, to where being sober for 20 years, I can't get away with not paying a $15 fine for my seatbelt and not go to jail. One of my great friends who just died 3 weeks ago of this disease was a lawyer, Paul B. And Paul came up to Cobb County Jail to see what he could do to help me out. And it turns out they didn't, why he came up at all, they knew he couldn't do anything. But he was dressed in a pair of red shorts and a loud Hawaiian shirt. And he just wanted to come up and talk to me for a minute and laugh at me for being so stupid not to pay the fine correctly. I don't know where I'd be today without this program. I don't know where I would be today without the help I receive from my friends. You know, I never had friends drinking and using. I had acquaintances. I had people that I could count on to do certain things at certain times. But today I had people that if something is happening that I can call, and they can help me out however I need. What a great thing that is for me, for someone who never wanted to be a part of anyone or anyone else's life. That just wasn't what I was. My wife and I are part of another club right down the street. We're both on the board, and it means so much to me to be able just to go into a place where I'm always safe. And it's the same way I feel when I come into this room. Nothing bad's going to happen for this hour. You know, everything that's going to happen in here is going to be good. I'm going to hear something that's going to help me with my day. I'm going to see somebody that's going to put a smile on my face. And I'm going to be able to share just a little bit of what's going on with me. And that's what my life is today. And that's what it is every day. I never thought I'd be this old. I hope I live for a long time further now. In the past, it just didn't matter. It just didn't matter. I want to do different things. For years, I never traveled. I was afraid of it. I was afraid of what I'd do. When I was 18, I flew for the first time, went down to Florida. And at the time, they just ran, in summertime, they ran jets. Eastern ran a shuttle from Atlanta to Fort Lauderdale once an hour. And it was first come, first serve. There were hundreds of people there. I was on the sixth or seventh flight. And I was drunk as a skunk because I was scared about flying to begin with. I'd never done it. By the time I got back down to Florida, my ride was long gone because I was supposed to be in 6 hours before. And I know, guys, that y'all may not believe this, but this was before cell phones. And there was no way to call these people. And I got into a little tussle with a baggage handler that thought it was funny that I wasn't going to be able to get a ride or a hotel room because that town was sold out that weekend. Today I can go to the airport and I can put up with TSA. Today I can sit in an airplane seat and be quiet and read and enjoy the experience. I never enjoyed experiences in the past. Events were just something you had to live through. Just had to grin and bear it. Today, I enjoy 6 grandkids. I enjoy my 2 kids. I have a daughter that lives up in Maryland, and she will come down here and visit, and occasionally I will fly up there and drive down with her. 3 years ago, I did that, and her boys were 4 and 6 at the time. And the youngest one was second to get to the bathroom, and he should have been first. And he had a little accident before he could get in there, and he finally got in there, and then he locked the door and wouldn't get off the toilet to unlock it to help him. And through a series of events with his brother, he ended up staying in there about 20 minutes. And I finally had to leave the bathroom. And this boy taking his clothes off finally, and I'm trying to get new clothes for him. And all I'm thinking about is here I am on 85 South in South Carolina, and policeman's going to walk through the door, and here's a naked 4-year-old, and I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life as a pedophile. And, you know, I'm just kind of laughing at myself for that. And I go to open the door, and there's 2 state troopers coming right in. And one of them was a sergeant, and I said, "Sergeant, my grandson's in there, and he's had a little accident. Would you mind looking after him for a minute?" And it was no problem. I can't even imagine that if I was drunk. What I would have done, who I would have done it to. Guys, I have no idea what time it is. This time? All right. I guess I just want to close with 2 things. I never came in here wanting to be sober. Never wanted to stop drinking. Never wanted to stop doing drugs. I knew I had to, but I didn't want to. I was able to stay in long enough to want to. The other thing is, I have done everything wrong you can do in sobriety. And I'm still sober. And it's because of a God of my understanding and great people in every one of these rooms that I'm a part of. And for that, guys, I'll be forever grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your story, Buster. I could relate to a lot of it. I grew up in Catholic schools, too. So I've asked Kat to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey, y'all. I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. And I am a true Buckhead native. I grew up on a dead-end street, and I went to private school. So right there with you. But we have a chip system, just like a lot of other places. If you are coming in or coming back, we offer a white chip. Come on up. Any other takers for a white chip? After 30 days and 30 nights, we have a silver chip. Okay, 90 days or 3 months, whichever comes first. yellow chip for 6 months, green chip for 9 months, blue chip for years or multiples thereof.
Still, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you announced. Bruce, alcoholic. Thank you. 10 years. So. Just very grateful for the program and everybody I met in it, and just one day at a time. So thanks.
Any other birthdays? Any takers on the white chip?
I'm doing months.
You already did 6 months.
I was out of the
Oh, you want 6 months?
Come on.
Come on. Did I miss anybody? All right, thank God for the chip fuel.
Thanks, Kat. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had an insane notion I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. I got a nudge from the judge, Lord, it put me in recovery. Put the plug in the jug. Man,